So the hindrances are like black holes in the mind, where the gravitational force is so strong that our awareness gets sucked in and doesn't come out for a while. And so we don't want to be careful how close we get to them or how we relate to them, how we believe them, how much authority we invest in them, or we'll get swept up in them. Or if we're not attentive and clearly can recognize them, we can get swept up in them and all too easily. But one of the interesting things about these five hindrances, each one of them has many variations. Sensual desires, you know, as it comes in at least 31 flavors. And aversion has many flavors and all these many different things. And what we're asked to do is simply to recognize it as the hindrance. Sensual desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness, anxiety, and and for today, doubt. And there's something kind of intriguingly simple about not getting into the details of what they're about, but simply see, oh, there is doubt. There is ill will. And because it isn't so much that we have to understand everything about them, we have to understand them well enough so we don't fall into the black hole. Understand them well enough so that we could stay independent, stay peaceful, just kind of watch it go by. When I was growing up in the 1960s in Italy, sometimes I would walk in the parks in the town, and there were often these elderly gentlemen who'd be sitting in the park, seemingly for hours. And the ones that stuck in my memory were the ones who had a cane between their legs and had their both hands on top of the cane, and they just sit there and watch. And it so inspired me, because there was something about the peacefulness of them just sitting there. Maybe it was a, you know, prediction of my future meditation life, but I was inspired by this peacefulness and just there, and they seemed content and nowhere to go, nothing to do, nothing to be, and they just were just there. Many years later, I realized that they had probably been through a lot in their lifetime, because Italy went through two world wars and many other horrific things. So I wondered what background they had that maybe allowed them or made it so meaningful to just be able to sit there peacefully, safely, contentedly in this place. And it was it became, as a kid, my aspiration to grow old like that. And so someday I'll get a cane and put it between my legs and just sit there. And so I imagine that you're taking a train and you're at the train station. And the train station is kind of in a natural setting, so you're on the platform, it's outdoors, and beyond the train tracks, it's in big, beautiful fields and woods or mountains or something. And there's a bench on the platform. And maybe you don't have a cane yet, but you're sitting there and waiting for your train, and there's nowhere to go, nothing to do until the train comes. So you're sitting there peacefully, enjoying yourself. It's nice. And then a train comes, and you get all anxious. Is it the right train? Is it the train I'm supposed to take? You jump up and you walk up and down in circles around the train track, staring as it coming down, trying to see the name on the side. You see the name on the side of it, and you don't recognize what it is, and is this the train I'm supposed to take, or is it not the train I'm supposed to take? And you study the train, you investigate up and down, and just undecided. You have doubt about what to do, and you're kind of like a little bit, stuck. You don't know what to do, and train stops, people come off, people go on, but you're kind of frozen. You don't know what to do, and the train goes off. Okay, well, so you go back on the bench, and after a little while, you settle down, and it's peaceful and nice, and nice view. But then another train comes, and it has a different name on the side, but the same thing is, I'm not sure which train. You ask people, and they don't know, and I think this is the right one. Yeah, I think, but. And so, so all this doubt about what's the right train and which one should get on. So lots of them come by, and just like each time it's like, goes on like that for a few years. But at least for a few minutes you can sit peacefully. And, but then you discover that there's a schedule you can get from that, the station master. And it says, this train goes there and has the name of the train and where it goes. And, I want that train that goes to this place where I'm going. So then when the next time the train comes, you look at the schedule, you look at the name of the train, you look at your schedule again, and nope, this one doesn't go there. And you just sit. And after a while, you learn you can just stay in your seat. You don't have to be up, even stand up. Mm-hmm. Stay on your bench, and you can see. Nope. 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 Yes. And then you get on. And it turns out that you have a long trip, and so you have other train stations. And after a while, you learn the trick. You learn that have everyone, all these train stations have beautiful benches and wonderful places to just sit and be peaceful, and if you discover you don't have to lose your peace, because when the train comes, you know what they are. Oh, that's the train that goes. Nope. Oh yes, that one I can take. And then you get on the train, and I loved taking trains in Europe when I was a kid. It was something very comforting for me about the rhythm of the train and the chug, chug, chugging and looking out the window, and it's kind of cozy. And so it's kind of like you bring your park bench with you into the train. Keep your peace. So there's something about identifying the right train or identifying the trains which are not right and knowing which to get on and which to get off. And so a big part of this doubt factors, doubt has many factors. I'll talk more about different types. But one of the really huge ones is we don't know what thoughts, what mental states, what mental practices, we don't know which ones to pick up and which ones are important. And so we have doubt about what should I do here with this. Maybe this doubt that I'm having now, this is the real doubt. This is what I'm supposed to have doubt about. This is real. This is important. And I'm supposed to be kind of on the train platform, kind of just kind of like, like a chicken without its head or something, and because this is so important. So we get pulled into that doubt world. But if you can know that doubt is doubt, and doubt does not go to a good destination, certainly not going where you want to go, you can see the doubt train come. Oh, there's doubt. Just let it go. Stay on your bench. There comes restlessness. Just don't get involved. Don't give it authority. Don't invest in it. Don't pick it up. Don't be so reactive to it. Just watch it. Chances are it'll stop at the station, tempt you for a while, and then it'll head out. Don't leave your bench. Desire and hostility, ill will, those trains will come by. But you know what? That's what it is. That's ill will. And I know that ill will, I don't, that's not the train to get on. And so, the lack of understanding about what to get involved in, what to pick up, and what to not pick up, is said to be one of the main causes of this doubt in the that happens in practice. And so it's kind of like, to use a different metaphor, the Buddha uses, there's a fork in the road, and we don't know which fork to take. We don't know which train to take. And the very simple teachings of the Buddha are there, is that there are two categories of things you can do with your mind and things you can get involved in. There are those which are helpful and those which are not. And the way that is most commonly talked about is those things which are wholesome and those things which are not, those things which are unwholesome, skillful and unskillful. And to be able to know this is unwholesome, this is not helpful, and this is helpful, is one of the skills that over time we develop in this practice. And then we start recognize something's unskillful, unhelpful. Nope, I'm not going to get on that train. So in terms of the hindrances, after a while, the fact that we don't have to know all the details of each hindrance. We don't have to get in there, investigate, and know, because there's so many kinds. You know, you'll spend a lifetime if you want to understand all the hindrances. But it's enough, just sometimes, just, oh, there's ill will, I'm not getting involved in that. And then you say, well, I'm a bad person because I have ill will. Nope. That's also unhealthy to have that kind of self-criticism. Nope. And you can't necessarily control what bubbles up in your mind. You know, the mind does what it does. But you have some ability, choice, about whether to believe in it, get involved in what goes on in your mind, or not. And that distinction is really important. And it's hard to really feel or see or understand that this is the case. We're not necessarily responsible for what comes up in our mind. So you don't necessarily have to be, feel bad if you end up with murderous rage. Just pops up, boom, there it is, fascinating. But we are responsible for whether we get involved in it, believe in it, invest in it, participate in it, spin out with it. So if you can stay on your bench peacefully and see, there's the murderous rage train. I guess, you know, I think it's going to stop here for a while, but I'm not going to leave the bench. I'm just going to wait until it leaves the station, which it will. And so part of what we're doing in practice is learning the place where we can sit on the bench, the equivalent. A place of some kind of stability, some place where we can see clearly and peacefully, some place where we feel content, at home. We have maybe some feeling of, like, this is right, I'm just here. Some feeling some ability to be here, kind of like be here and see the train over there. Be here and see, oh, that's desire, that's sensual desire. I didn't choose for sensual desire to happen. It was just mystery why suddenly I started to think about a sexual partner. But boy, did I get on that train. And I had lots of choices to get off. The bell rang for the end of the sitting. I could have gone up and walked, but I was right, you know, getting close to the climax. And so, you know, I'm going to stay and see what happens here. You know, if sometimes if we look carefully, we see that we do have some choice in this matter. You know, and we get involved and, oh, this is getting, you know, whatever it is. But what is that place in you where you can kind of sit on your bench and see what's there. Don't get seduced with the idea that that you have to identify with it, that you have to take ownership of it. Don't be seduced in the idea that just because these hindrances arise, they are defining you. They're part of your resume now. And you know, it's kind of very unfortunate because this is who you are. You kind of get caught up in the whole identity thing with them, or think that they create a bad character reference for us or something. But just, you know, you don't have to do anything, but it just arose. I'm not going to take responsibility for what my mind does all the time. But I'm going to stay here and just know it, see it, but I'm not going to leave the bench. I'm going to stay rooted and settled and here. And so one important aspect of this ability to stay on your bench and not get up and run around the platform or even get onto the train is to identify what it is, to see it for what it is, the ability to be mindful and to recognize. And it's enough sometimes just to say, that's doubt. You don't have to know all the different aspects of what doubt is or the details of it. All you have to do is to have that clear seeing and stay on your bench and just clearly not get involved. You don't have to like it. You don't have to not like it. It's whatever you do, just don't get on. And then at some point, the right train comes along. A good train comes along. And then if you know how to identify that one you might get on. And those trains are nice. They're like my childhood trains where it was so cozy and comforting. And it felt kind of safe to be on these trains. And they were rocking a little bit. So in the teachings of the Buddha, he taught about the five hindrances together with another list. And they represent the two forks in the road, or the trains to avoid and the trains to get on. So the hindrances are the trains to avoid. And what's called the seven factors of awakening are the trains to get on. And so when you see those coming, get on them. Participate in them and support them and nourish them. And so the first one is mindfulness itself. So if you get a sense, now I'm being mindful. This is mindful. This is observing. This is being present. Stay in that. Support it. Nourish it. Get involved in it. Usually the second one is called an investigation. Turns out what it really means is the ability to differentiate between what is wholesome and unwholesome, between what is helpful and not helpful. And so if you're kind of being able to see, nope, that's not good, that's not helpful, that's helpful, that's really great. Keep that going. The application of effort. If you're making good effort, keep doing it. If there's joy arising or a sense of satisfaction or happiness around the practice, by all means, enjoy it and, kind of go for the ride with it. If there's tranquility, some degree of calm and peace, by all means, kind of rest in it, enjoy it, let it fill you. That's a good train to be on. And if there is concentration beginning, you might want to be very careful with yourself, or tender, or just kind of, safeguard yourself a little bit to let the concentration stay there and develop and build up. And then equanimity. There's a sense of non-reactivity to what's happening. In a way, the non-reactivity is so palpable, and it's almost like an emotion. You kind of, whatever happens, I'm not being reactive or being pushed around or liking or not liking. It's just, wow, this is good. Now, if you get attached to the seven factors of awakening, or you're expecting them, they're demanding them, or if you want to, you know, ask the teachers for, you know, the IRC medal. You know, that we have, you know, we should have medals, right? Meditation medals, and, you know, and some people are way down with lots of medals, and, you know, so because you want to, you know, you want to be able to show that you've got something out of this, and so medals will do it, right? So if you want to get the, you know, I'm gonna really do this equanimity so I can get the equanimity medal. All those things are unwholesome. They're not helpful. So they're like different trains coming along. So you don't want to get on those trains. But if you feel that the seven factors of awakening are arising, coming along a little bit, and you say, ah, this is good, this is helpful, I think this is supportive, and I think this is something to cultivate and develop and nurture, protect. There's no attachment. That can be a healthy feeling, healthy direction. So then you can go ahead with it. Now with the hindrances, when they arise, what is your relationship to them? Is there how we relate to them healthy or unhealthy? How we relate to them wholesome or unwholesome? So I might have ill will arise, and now I hate the ill will, and I hate myself for having it. I hate the meditation center where I have ill will. I hate the weather because, you know, this, you know, once you're into ill will, you know, you might as well not stop. And so this idea of, you know, recognizing, oh, that's unhealthy. I don't get on that train. I have ill will. I have this second hindrance. But this reaction I have to it, I don't have to get onto that train. I can just let it be ill will. So with doubt, just doubt. No shame, no pride, no animosity, no, you know, just to see it. So what happens over time in practice, we start getting a second sense or an instinct or a clear understanding of what is healthy and what is not, what is wholesome, what is not. Or to say it in more practical terms, what in the very reaction or way of being, or the very train that's there, there's an ouch. Versus those where there's an ah. There's kind of very visceral, very kind of meaning, that's good. That's not so useful, and that's painful or something. And to be able to recognize that, ah, look at that. Okay. I'm not going to get on that train, and I'm not going to bring in other trains. I'm not going to, you know, there's all these trains that come along. Nope, nope, nope. And then if you can, you know, wait for the good trains and support the good trains to come. And so part of the practice is, in fact, the ability to say no. Nope, nope. But it's that simple, it's that light. Nope, as opposed to no. You know, tremendous hostility. Nope. Nope. And then if the right train comes along and you want to say yes, it's the same thing. Oh, yes. It's not like, oh boy, yes. You know, just yes. Kind of simple. But the key thing is this ability to stay grounded and kind of stay in your seat, hold your seat, hold your ground. I'm going to change the metaphor. Stand on your stand on your own two feet, and be able to not to know what to goes on. When I was in Zen, in Japan, I asked the Zen teacher there, "How do you know when to give someone Dharma transmission?" And the person said, "When the person can stand on their own two feet, can rely on themselves." So you know, maybe in my metaphor today, you know, the person can stay on their bench. And not get swept up and get anxious. So this is one of the, so not understanding and not knowing what is helpful and not helpful, wholesome and unwholesome, is one of the tradition's definitions of what makes up this doubt, this uncertainty, this vacillation, indecisiveness that goes on. And And so not knowing that, people are going to run around on the platform, people kind of are uncertain what to do, and you know, can it get, you know, and that can be very debilitating. There are other forms of doubt that can happen, and there's doubt about the practice we're doing. There's doubt about the teachers that are teaching us. There's doubt about the retreat center. There's doubt about our own ability to practice. Doubt about whether it's the right day to practice. All kinds of things that we can doubt. And doubt is considered to be the most dangerous of the hindrances, because it's the one that people most likely, the one that's most likely going to cause people to give up the practice. So enough. I'm not going to do this. This is too much. I can't do it, or I don't think I can do it. And the sad thing about the doubt is the doubt about the practice. I don't think I can do this. It's too hard. It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't think I can do this. If we get pulled into that world, I don't think I can do it. It turns out that you can't. Those thoughts are the very thing that keeps you from being able to settle in and doing it. So then it's, you know, self-confirming kind of. Yep, I knew it. I couldn't do it. But it's because, you know, of the spinning out in these thoughts of I can't do it. So it's a little, you know, tricky, this whole thing. The mind is tricky, how to work with it. And sometimes doubt has to do with the teachings. Sometimes doubt has to do with not exactly doubt about something, but a lack of confidence in oneself or something. Or sometimes it's a belief. It's called doubt, but it's a belief that I can't do it. It isn't doubt about whether I can do it or I can't do it, but it's a clear belief that this doesn't work, this I can't do. And sometimes that's called doubt. And whether it should be called doubt or not, I don't know, but it's certainly one of the trains you don't want to get on. So ideally, we sit on our bench and just sit and say no to the trains that come along, and we don't make it complicated, and we don't say, you know, I'm a bad person, or I shouldn't have done that, or you know, just it's just doubt. It just, you know, there it is. And ideally, the mindfulness is strong enough that we just see, oh, doubt, 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 I see you, there's doubt. And we're able to kind of stay grounded on the bench, kind of, in our peace or in our stability, and just keep recognizing, keep recognizing, keep recognizing. And because it's hard to stay focused on doing that if we're only recognizing the same thing all the time, sometimes it's helpful, like with any of these hindrances, but to start recognizing what it feels like in the body. Not necessarily because that's going to be the key to make it go away. It's just a way of making sure you don't get caught, don't get pulled onto the train. So doubt can come along with feelings of deflation. It can come with feelings with tension. It can come with feelings of kind of feeling empty someplace inside. And so then just, okay, there's the emptiness, there's the tension, and there's the deflation, the energy that's going away, or there's the resistance that's present. And again, not to fix it, but just to have a place where, to help us recognize it, where we're here on the bench and there's the doubt. And so we see it physically. That's what it's like. Or we see it in the mind, as a thinking mind. Doubt generally involves a lot of thinking. And so it's possible to then recognize the energy of thinking, the tension of thinking, the pressure in the control tower that's there. And then staying on your bench, so pressure, tension, energy, just keep that place, trusting the knowing, trusting, just recognizing, don't get on the train. Sometimes, because it can involve so much thinking, then we get pulled into the black hole of doubt, sometimes very strongly. Not just because it's thinking, because it often comes with a lot of very compelling feelings. The emotions of doubt, the the feeling of maybe hopelessness, the feelings of even despair or discouragement that can come with doubt, can be very captivating, can be very kind of convincing, like this is true. It's, it becomes kind of like the mood of the universe. And so it's just inherent in the universe that that there's discouragement. It's nothing to do with me. It can be that kind of like, you know, intimate or complete. And so, but to, again, always to be able so sometimes we can't recognize, we can't step back, we can't stay on our bench, we get pulled into it so much. So then some of the emergency things you might do is count your breath. Sometimes if you really stay honed in best you can, it's kind of like manual labor, it doesn't have to look pretty, but you stay with the breath, count 1 to 10, start over again, count 1 to 10, just that's what you do. Slowly, the mind might be stronger than the doubt and the thoughts about doubt, that if you can just stay there, that thinking mind quiets down. And then you're kind of there, and then you can stop counting. Another thing you can do is to make sure to relax. I think generally if there's a lot of intense doubt, there's some tension somewhere. So is there some place you can relax? Can you relax around the eyes, the jaws, behind the forehead? Can you relax the shoulders, the belly, soften? Just soften. Sometimes what's needed is to do something where we're clearly that we're in charge, something we can do with confidence, and kind of remind ourselves or evoke confidence in us. Some people can do it by sitting up straight and really, you know, assuming a posture of confidence. One thing that sometimes works is to do walking meditation or just to walk. I've sent people out to walk, long distances and retreats because of their intense preoccupation with doubt. And so I tell them, walk as confidently as you can. Just really walk confidently. You don't have to be confident. Just walk confidently. Assume a posture and just walk back and forth. And somehow doing the walking in a very confident way, because hopefully most of you know how to walk well enough to be confident as walkers. You just walk. And this your psychophysical system starts getting a sense of, oh yeah, or the feeling of confidence, and that lack of confidence that can be the support for doubt begins to dissipate, begins to lessen, the first L of Bella. And or maybe there's something else that you can actually do that you have confidence in being able to do. By the fifth day of the retreat, if you're the dishwasher, you're confident in dishwashing. And so you kind of go down there and you try just do it with your added sense of confidence, just to kind of bring in a very different flavor inside that breaks the trance of the lack of confidence that's there. So those are kind of emergency measures to do if we just keep falling into these holes, these black holes, and they kind of have us by the net, by the nose, and it's just kind of like we can't seem to find and get ourselves out. If it's not an emergency, we have them, they come up. Sometimes it's good to give a little bit reflection on the nature of the doubt, because sometimes if it's what doubt is actually not having enough information, not knowing enough. And then if that's what it is, then maybe it's useful to ask a teacher. Maybe you don't understand how the technique works, or you don't understand what's supposed to happen, or where this is going, or how the teachings work. Why are we doing this? And so those might be reasonable questions to have. And so sometimes reading a Dharma book or talking to a teacher and getting some answers is very important. If what's the so-called doubt really is just not knowing, and So that can be helpful sometimes. And then another thing to look at with doubt is how much is the doubt we have related to the way in which we think about ourselves, the identity that we form, the persona that we think we're supposed to be and for the world and how we present ourselves. And is somehow the doubt related to how I think about myself? And is it that the hook that gets me in? So that if I'm sitting and meditating, and I'm not really getting concentrated, and my mind wanders off a lot, and come back, and not going off, and then I start having doubt, is this really the right practice for me? But if I look more carefully, really where the discouragement is coming from that leads to these doubtful thoughts is that I thought I was going to come to the retreat and just be the most shining meditator of them all, and you know, on the brink of full, perfect, unsurpassable enlightenment, and now, you know, I bet everyone sees me as can read my mind and know that I'm a total meditation klutz. And so I feel so bad about myself. Who wants to be a meditation klutz? And so the discouragement has a lot to do with self-image or self, what stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. That's just another train. You don't have to feel bad about having that train, but there's this wonderful place of freedom where you see it as a train and you say, nope. Or if no is too negative, then you just see it as a train and you wave as it goes by. Let it go. And try to cheer up the people that are on the train. And so they the tradition says that the doubt is not overcome until a person attains the first level of liberation. When a person has a very clear experience of what liberation is, a mind that's free. Because then we really know what it's all about. We know what the practice is about. We have a sense of what it's like to sit completely peacefully on the bench. Completely like we're home, we're connected, we're not troubled by anything, not needing to hold on to anything or cling to anything or resist anything or push anything away, no longer trying to build up a sense of self or a persona, but all the persona thing has just dropped as well. And we're just kind of here on the bench. And to really have that experience and to know the possibility of sitting peacefully on the bench in a full way, then they say there's no more doubt about what the practice is about. Oh, this is what it's about. This deep letting go of all those things. And as opposed to, enlightenment is supposed to be about cosmic consciousness, or it's supposed to be about having a certain kind of samadhi, or it's supposed to be some fantastic mind-shattering insight and big explosions and of things and something in the mind. It's actually very simple. It's to recognize the peace that comes when we have let go. So it's kind of not anything. It's the absence of clinging. And that's what the practice is about. And that's when, to really know, and until we have that experience, you can expect that you'll have doubt and uncertainty. It's not a personal failing that you should have doubt. You can expect it. It'll come. It'll be around. But it's just a train. It's just another train. How many in your lifetimes, how many trains have you gotten on? I bet you've done a lot of train rides. Some people have to spend more time on trains, and they just jumped between trains. And they've forgotten, they're so long, they've even forgotten there are train platforms and benches. Some place where you can sit and just be and settle and be peaceful. So, repeating something I've said, I think is important, is that these words for the five hindrances are kind of like help there to help us make it simple. We don't necessarily have to know all the details of every single hindrance. We have to just know it well enough to recognize it as being unskillful, unhelpful, not something to pick up and be involved in. So just see it as ill will. Oh, that's ill will. Wave as it goes by. But sometimes they stop for the night, these trains, and you have to kind of be patient. There's sensual desire. There's doubt. There's restlessness that's coming along. Restlessness is kind of fun. Can be fun. There were times many years ago I had a lot of restlessness, and it was like being at the rodeo. So I just kind of got into it. I just kind of and I remember one day I was sitting with a lot of restlessness, and I imagined that it was ping pong balls inside of me, and because so much energy is bouncing around inside, so I just kind of settled back and watched the ping pong balls, and that was like a delight, and so I just changed how I related to it. So that was a good train to be on, that playful train, just it's playful, just restless. And then, because I had made space for it and just watched it, kind of the restlessness in a kind of playful way, it quieted down after a while. So, so then to end, I want to say that these hindrances, it's so useful to recognize them. And to realize this is not where to be. To recognize them for what they are. Because if we get absorbed or caught in them or get in those trains, they cover over, they obscure our beauty. They obscure the preciousness of our human life. They obscure our dignity, our value, obscure our ability to really love and what's tender and sweet about us. Too much hindrances, and we believe there's nothing sweet and beautiful about ourselves. But every single human being has tremendous beauty inside, tremendous goodness that's often covered over, and there's some covered over by hindrances. So to be able to sit and be mindful, sit on your bench and just recognize what's there, and not be caught by it, is a way to come home or to begin recognizing, coming back to what's really good in us. And if you have doubts that there's anything good in you, that's just a doubt train. You don't have to believe it. You can just, there's a train. There is plenty of good in you. And when you start recognizing or feeling or believing there's goodness here that's worth tapping into, that's a good train to be on. Breathe with it, settle in, feel your way in. See if you can reach in deep inside. You're sitting here, kind of have the mind be still, reach deep, deep inside of you, and see if you can touch what's tender, what's loving, what's kind, what's sweet, what's pure, what's wise. Maybe different days you'll touch different things, but can you reach inside and touch what's beautiful inside of you? And then breathe with that. Settle into that. Maybe that can be your bench from which you recognize the trains that come and go. So we can take a couple of minutes to sit on our benches and see what comes and goes.